From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne with Fresh Air. We've sent Terry Gross on vacation, but we've held on to a couple of her interviews to play for you today. Writer Wallace Stegner has described the remaining wilderness of the western United States as the geography of hope. He grew up there when the century was young, his father lured by visions of opportunity and wealth that never materialized. On today's Fresh Air, a talk with Wallace Stegner about living and writing in the West. Also, a history of lesbian subcultures in 20th century America. A talk with Lillian Faderman, author of Odd Girls and Twilight Lovers. And rock historian Ed Ward fills us in on the whereabouts of one eccentric British ex-rocker. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush announced this afternoon that all parties in the Mideast peace process have now agreed to resume their talks. The president said the talks will begin again in Washington on August 24th. The announcement came after a day of meetings with Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. Alan Dowd of Maine Public Broadcasting reports.
The administration continues to hint that an agreement is near on new U.S. loan guarantees for Israel, but there's still no official announcement. A senior official described the sessions between the two leaders as warm and cordial. He said Mr. Bush and Rabin covered a lot of ground, including loan guarantees. The U.S. has refused to guarantee $10 billion in loans sought by Israel, in part to protest the building of settlements in the occupied territories. Rabin has imposed a partial freeze on those settlements, but not to the extent the U.S. has sought. An official said there were still some issues to be resolved, but he declined to elaborate. The two leaders are scheduled to meet with reporters tomorrow morning, so any announcement would likely come then. For National Public Radio, I'm Alan Dowd in Kennebunkport.
Republicans are at work on their party platform in advance of next week's national convention in Houston, calling for a repeal of a 1990 tax hike and a firm stand against abortion. The party's economic subcommittee wants a repeal of the tax hikes that were part of the deficit reduction agreement signed by the president 2 years ago. The agreement violated the president's no new taxes pledge of 1988, and Mr. Bush has since said that he made a mistake in signing it. There were just three supporters of abortion rights on a 20-member subcommittee handling the platform's call for a constitutional amendment to ban abortion. The abortion rights proposals were shut out on a parliamentary maneuver. Activists on both sides of the abortion issue confronted one another in the streets of Houston today. Leaders of Operation Rescue defied a temporary restraining order. Mike Rosen reports from member station KUHF.
The street in front of Houston Planned Parenthood was filled with two or three dozen police officers. On the clinic side were a couple hundred abortion rights activists chained together to keep the clinic open, and on the other side were several members of Operation Rescue, gathered less than 100 feet from Planned Parenthood in defiance of the court order. Operation Rescue National spokesman Reverend Pat Mahoney tore up a copy of that order.
This is an outrage. The city of Houston and the state of Texas is getting off on the wrong foot for the Republican convention, chilling our First Amendment rights.
Mahoney called today's nonviolent protest the second Boston Tea Party, saying anti-abortion activists won't tolerate tyranny or oppression. No arrests were made, but several fines could be issued of up to $10,000. More rallies are planned for the next 2 weeks. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Rosen in Houston.
Stock prices closed slightly higher today after a day of mixed trading. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 5 points to close at 3,337.58. This is NPR News. Attorney General William Barr said today there's not enough evidence to warrant an independent counsel's investigation of the Bush administration's policy toward Iraq before the invasion of Kuwait. Democrats immediately charged that Barr was attempting to cover up information that could be embarrassing to President Bush in an election year. Barr was responding to a request for an independent prosecutor filed by Democrats on the House Judiciary Committee. New York Democrat Charles Schumer said that the decision was an attempt to sweep the whole issue under the rug. Negotiators for the Communications Workers of America have reached a tentative contract agreement with five telephone companies serving the Midwest. From Chicago, John Dempsey of member station WBEZ reports.
The union reached the deals early this morning with the five subsidiaries of the Chicago-based Ameritech Corporation. The agreements cover workers with Illinois, Michigan, Ohio, and Wisconsin Bell, as well as Ameritech Services Incorporated. The settlement covers more than 34,000 Ameritech workers. The old contract expired at midnight Saturday, but was extended while talks continued. A union leader says the agreements with each local phone company will differ, but he says all of the contracts are for well over 12% increases in base wages and other benefits. For National Public Radio, I'm John Dempsey in Chicago.
Reports from Jordan say that Iraqi President Saddam Hussein has sent a high-level envoy to Amman to try to persuade Iraqi merchants there to resume their trade with Iraq. Shipments of food and medicine to Iraq are said to have been at a near standstill for the past 2 weeks, since more than 40 Iraqi merchants were reported to have been shot in Baghdad. One version of the story said that the merchants were executed for alleged profiteering. The Associated Press reports a more recent version, which said some merchants were killed and some wounded in a shootout during an argument with the Iraqi Interior Minister. The overland truck route from Jordan is Iraq's major source of food. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Wallace Stegner has been called the dean of Western writers. He doesn't write about Western myth. He writes about the landscape and how it's been changed by development. And he writes about the people who settled the West and the generations that followed. But as one critic wrote, Stegner's main region is the human spirit, how one achieves a sense of identity, permanence, a sense of home in a place where rootlessness and discontinuity dominate. Stegner was born in 1909 and grew up in a family that moved from place to place across the West. He won the Pulitzer Prize for his 1971 novel, Angle of Repose. And he holds an important place in American literature as a teacher as well as a writer. For 26 years, he headed the creative writing program at Stanford University. Stegner spoke with Terry Gross following the publication of his new book of essays. It's called Where the Bluebird Sings to the Lemonade Springs, Living and Writing in the West. Here's a reading from the introduction in which Stegner writes about the true believers and the wishful thinkers who settled the West, people like his father.
I know that historical hope, energy, carelessness, and self-deception. I knew it before I could talk. My father practically invented it, though he qualified more as sucker than as booster, and profited accordingly. He was a boomer from the age of 14, always on the lookout for the big chance, the ground floor, the inside track. As a youth, he tried the Wisconsin and Minnesota woods, but found only the migratory wage slavery that's always been one payoff of the American dream. He tried professional baseball, but wasn't quite good enough. In the 1890s, he floated out to North Dakota on the tail end of the land rush, but found himself in the midst of a 10-year drought and ended up speculating in wheat futures and running a blind pig. If you believe that the world owes you not merely a living but a bonanza, then restrictive laws are only an irritation and a challenge. When it became clear that Dakota's promises were indistinguishable from Siberian exile, my father dragged us out the migration route to the Northwest. His goal then was Alaska, but again he was late. The Klondike rush was long over. The survivors had straggled back. For a while he ran a lunchroom in the Washington woods where the Seattle suburb of Redmond now is. The loggers cut down the trees and left the lunchroom among the stumps. By 1914, we were up in Saskatchewan, part of another land rush, where for a change we would be in on the ground floor and make a killing growing wheat to feed Europe's armies.
Do you think of your father's personality as being typical of a certain kind of restless loser who populated the West?
Not always a loser, you know. He was characteristic, I think, but sometimes they were losers and sometimes they were big winners. He was a product of his times, and though I used to resent him a great deal, I find that now I feel rather sorry for him. I think he was made by his times. At the end of a frontier, when there was no longer the kind of frontier opportunity that for so long had been part of the American consciousness. And he tried a lot of things and none of them worked, or very few of them worked.
So did you really resent it when you were young and every time he had a new scheme, you had to move?
Well, he was a frustrated man, and sometimes he took out his frustration on whatever was handy. But that too, I can understand. I'm sometimes frustrated, and I take it out on some people, too.
You write, my father wanted to make a killing and end up on Easy Street. I wanted to hunt up and rejoin the civilization I had been deprived of. Where did you go looking for it?
Oh, school and the public libraries, primarily. There was a big division between my home life, because neither of my parents was educated even to high school. So that there was no background of cultivation, reading, anything else. Though my mother was a reader, she didn't know what to read. She had no guide. She would have had a good deal of cultural capacity, you know, if she'd had any guidance, but she didn't. And I got mine from school and from the public libraries, where I took out 7 books a week and read most of them.
Writer Wallace Stegner is my guest. Had you grown up on the myths and the folklore and the cliches of the West, you know, the cowboy stories?
Oh, sure. I grew up not only on the myth, but among cowboys. When we moved to Canada, we were in the tail end of a period of cattle raising, which had been pretty well wiped out in 1906 and 7 by a terrible winter. But in the protected edge of the hills where we lived, there were still cattle ranches, and lots of cowpunchers still working on ranches, hired men on horseback. They weren't the romantic figures that the myth made of them. They were also, as a class, I should say, very macho, somewhat callous, somewhat brutal. Nice guys in a way, but brutal. And they also had a code of hating the crybaby, hating anything unlike themselves, despising anything womanish or oversensitive.
There might have been no room there for somebody who spent a lot of time reading, like you.
Well, I don't know. I got into the cowboy business quite a lot as a boy, but by the time I moved out of it, I was a little tired of it, because I had some little physical defects. My hands were always cold, for one thing, and you can't live in Saskatchewan with cold hands and like it. things like that. So that I resented sometimes the harshness of the code, though I was always trying to live up to it.
But what about reading? Where did that fit in? I mean, for the kind of brutal macho code that you're describing, that doesn't seem to fit with the boy.
There wasn't any reading up there.
Yeah.
Up in Canada, you know, there was no public library. Every family there may have had 3 books. We traded them all over town. Sometimes they never came back. My father, at one point in his life, got excited about, I guess he'd seen a Shakespeare play, so he bought a set of Shakespeare from a traveling salesman. We had that. Hmm. We had a few things like that. Mostly what we read was magazines, I suppose, and later when we got onto them, Tarzan stories and things like that.
I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, but when I was young, my dreams were about being a cowgirl. I mean, I would literally dream,
yep.
You know, about riding a horse and wearing a leather outfit and, you know, the whole Western myth. I grew up watching Westerns on the movies and on TV, and I just loved them.
Yep.
And I'm wondering, like, growing up in the West and knowing actual cowboys, what effect those kinds of movies and novels had on you? You grew up before television.
Yeah, sure. I grew up a long time before television, and I was never actually very, very taken by the Western myth, because I knew how far it was from the actual facts. A cowboy's life is spent punching post holes and branding and castrating and things like that, and very hard work and very low pay, and his celebrated liberty is generally the liberty to quit his bad job and go get another one just as bad. In terms of his migratoriness, his placelessness, his uprootedness, he was very often as bad off as a contemporary crop worker. And he's not a romantic figure in life, though very often real cowboys imitate their mythical counterparts and try to think themselves into that role. So I'm a little anti-cowboy. You've got the wrong coon here to to talk to.
You're just joining us. My guest is writer Wallace Stegner, and he has a new collection called Where the Bluebird Sings to the Lemonade Springs, Living and Writing in the West. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Writer Wallace Stegner is my guest. I'm interested in hearing how you've seen the West change as a literary place. You once wrote, there are thousands more federal employees in the West than there are cowboys. There may be more writers. At what point in your life did the West start to become a place that was considered to be a place that had writers living there, writing about the region with a distinctive voice, as publishers from the region publishing those distinctive voices?
That came pretty late in my life. I had graduated from college, I think, at the age of 20 or 21, before I ever saw a writer. It seemed to me that writers were people who lived a long time ago and a long way off, and it never occurred to me that I could be one or should be one, even though I liked to write, and it was encouraged a little bit in school. I suppose it never occurred to me really to take seriously the notion of being a writer until I went away to graduate school in Iowa, and there I was offered the chance to write some stories for an MA thesis and jumped at the chance. And, you know, a couple of those were published in little magazines or so. That's the extent of that. And that was the middle of the Depression, and I couldn't stay on. There was no job outside, so I stayed on in school, but I couldn't stay on just to be a writer, so I took a PhD in American literature. And that pretty well killed the writing impulse for several years. It takes a long time to get over that. But about 2 years after that, I was back teaching in Salt Lake, and I sat down one afternoon and wrote a story in about 3 hours about Saskatchewan. And somebody, I guess the Virginia Quarterly, bought it, and then I was hooked. But that was pure accident. In Iowa, I had met a few writers, and I had certainly got a notion that writing was something that happened among contemporary living people. But it still hadn't jarred my consciousness that I could pretend to compete in that area.
So you said that the West became a place identified with writers, or writers identified with the West. Later in your life, when did you really feel that starting to happen?
Well, not for quite a while. I lived in Cambridge, Mass. For a while and taught at Harvard, and I met a lot of writers, some of whom were from the West, and I certainly had my mind opened up to possibilities. I guess I myself considered at that point that Western writing was some inferior, second-rate genre. I didn't have very many pretensions as a writer myself, though I had written a couple of novels. And when I wrote The Big Rock Candy Mountain, which was about the West, that more or less typecast me. By the time I had come out to Stanford, which was right at the end of World War II, there obviously was much more going on, and the GI students who came to Stanford showed up with a lot of talent and an enormous backed-up flood of energy and enthusiasm. That was the time when I really began to get enthusiastic about the possibilities in the West.
Mm-hmm.
And when we founded the writing program at Stanford, which is still going.
Yeah, well, I think you headed that creative writing program at Stanford for about 26 years. So, I mean, it's probably fair to say that you had a lot to do with nurturing a lot of the writers
from the West. I
hope I had
some, yeah. I hope I had some effect. I'm sure I had some little effect. Not necessarily by teaching, but by example, because by then I was pretty deep in writing about the West, both as history and as fiction.
Mm-hmm.
I was writing only, you know, about what I knew and what I liked to write about, and there was nothing very deliberate about that. It just turned out that way.
You know, writing requires such patience and reworking. And it seems like as a writer, you'd have to have the opposite kind of temperament that your father had. Your father always looking for a bonanza to pan out and moving to the next place. How do you feel you got the temperament necessary to write, given the background that you grew up in?
Well, partly because I was pretty much in constant rebellion against my father, so anything he did, I would do the opposite. But also, I suppose, getting a Ph.D. teaches you patience. Believe me, you sit a long time just looking at books until the type begins to run and blur, and sitting at looking at blank walls and listening to blank voices. Patience is something learned to... When you have a book to write, particularly a long book, a novel, you have to go there 7 days a week, 4 hours a day, sit in that chair, and one of the earliest things you have to learn is to keep your seat in that chair, or don't vacate it very long. Just get up and walk around and come back and sit down. That's something that I think the profession itself teaches you. If you're going to stay in it, you have to learn it.
Mm-hmm. You taught at Stanford for about 26 years, the creative writing program. How do you think your teaching was different when you retired from what it was when you started?
It was tireder. There are some occasions when you're teaching a writing class, which has to be Socratic. You know, you can't tell them how to do it. You have to sort of help them find how to do it, which sometimes after a 2-hour seminar would leave me feeling as if I'd carried the whole class up 4 flights of stairs on my back. That gets wearing. And sometimes, of course, the class doesn't meld. It just doesn't blend. It never comes together. I don't know quite what magic and chemistry is involved there, but 6 out of 7 or 8 times it would be wonderful, a really exhilarating kind of class to teach. And once, maybe 2 or 3 times during my 26 years, it was just a load, just a load.
Do you feel that you did some of your students a favor by telling them not to write?
I hardly ever had the nerve to tell somebody not to write. You're dealing with such sensibilities that any harsh criticism of something so intimate as a piece of fiction that somebody is determined to write is very hard on the soul of the person who has to receive that criticism. Sometimes it would save them a lot of trouble. To be told, no, I don't think you have a speck of talent. You have sometimes you're intelligent, straight A-plus students and so on, you still can't do it. The gift is not there. And without the gift, there's nothing much that can be learned. You can't teach people much. I have discouraged some young writers. I think they needed discouraging. But they were not the kind who were passionately devoted to their art. They were, essentially, they liked the idea of being writers, but they really didn't have that drive to write. So I could discourage them without killing them off. But some writers I would be very, very careful not to discourage entirely.
Mm-hmm.
Let them find out for themselves over a period, long, painful period of apprenticeship that didn't produce anything. That's the only way it would be psychically sound, I think, to tell them, let them tell themselves.
You live part of the year in Vermont, which is way out east. How did somebody so associated with the West as yourself end up living part of the year in the East?
Well, actually, I've lived in Vermont, had a house in Vermont longer than anywhere else in my life. We went there when I was teaching at the University of Wisconsin to visit some friends, and before we left, we reached down into our very thin depression period purse and bought us an old farm, a real back farm, and put a few $100 into fixing it up and used it for a few summers. All the time we were at Harvard, we used it. And once we got out to Stanford, we missed a couple of years, and then we began going back because we like it. In many ways, Vermont reminds me of the West before the West began to be clear-cut and despoiled. because Vermont heals. You can clear cut a Vermont wood, and for a while it'll just come up to Christmas trees and brush and fireweed and so on. But you turn your back for a few years and it's a young forest, and you turn your back for 15 years and you've got a woods again. That's not true in the West. The West doesn't heal in the same way. So I like Vermont because it is, though it's greener than any country I was brought up in, it is healthy. It smells the right way.
You wrote a few years ago, "Except when I have to tie my shoelaces, I don't feel 80 years old. But if I don't feel decrepit, neither do I feel wise or confident." Does that still describe how you feel?
Yeah, I'm afraid it does, because, partly I think we are a little less optimistic as the effects of age begin to catch up with us. But also, perhaps this is an absolutely cultural, predictable response. Everything looks better from the time we were young. Everything in the past looks better than the present. But I can't see much to cheer about in the present. It seems to me politics are dirtier. In terms of the West, the spoliation of the air, water, and soil, and grass, and trees is worse. We're getting closer and closer to using up what we were given, and there's nothing being replaced.
You wrote that with age you neither feel wise nor confident. Have you been waiting for wisdom, and have you always believed that wisdom comes with age and you can count on that?
There was a time when I thought I was wise, but I don't think so anymore. I think we are all more confident of ourselves in our youth, because confidence goes with physical competence and energy and the rest of it. I am not that confident anymore, and I'm not so sure that I was ever wise, you know. The things that happen, you get somehow bent by circumstances. And I used to be a real prig about my father. I really hated him, you know, for the things that he had done and for his general attitudes. The longer I go, the more I feel sorry for him. And that's almost a sadder business than disliking him.
We know you wrote that he died penniless and friendless in a flea bag hotel. Were you his friend when he died?
We were still in correspondence, yeah. I was trying to help him a little. I couldn't very much because that was in the Depression still. But he gambled on too many gold mines and so on. And the word I used was sucker, which is unkind, but that's really what he was. He believed in these things that would happen, these good things that would happen. It never occurred to him that if they were going to happen, somebody much better healed and better informed than he would already have taken advantage of him.
Writer Wallace Stegner speaking with Terry Gross. His new book of essays is called Where the Bluebird Sings to the Lemonade Springs. And a new edition of his 1971 Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, Angle of Repose, was published earlier this year by Penguin. I'm Marty Moscowane, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscowane with Fresh Air. Coming up, a history of lesbian subcultures in 20th century America. We'll talk to writer Lillian Faderman. She says the changes in lesbian life this century reveal important shifts in American attitudes towards class and gender. And rock historian Ed Ward tells us about his re-encounter with an eccentric British ex-rocker who once again is making music. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. At the United Nations, the five permanent members of the Security Council met behind closed doors today to discuss a U.S. proposed resolution on Bosnia. The measure would authorize a possible use of force to deliver humanitarian aid to the war-torn country. Linda Fasulo has more from the U.N.
The U.S. has been pressing hard for agreement on a draft resolution that would allow the use of all measures necessary, including military force, to bring food and medicine to Bosnia. After securing agreement of its European allies, Britain, France, and Belgium, the U.S. turned to securing support from Russia and China. Diplomats say the proposed measure would be mandatory and would call for the opening of safe corridors for relief deliveries from the Adriatic Sea to Sarajevo and anywhere else within Bosnia. This could include routes to detention camps as well. The full Security Council is expected to discuss the proposed measure behind closed doors Tuesday, and a vote could come as soon as Wednesday. Meanwhile, a separate resolution is being worked on that would deal with reported mistreatment of civilians and prisoners in detention camps. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo at the United Nations.
Western military experts say the United Nations arms embargo isn't stopping weapons from getting to the former Yugoslavia's warring factions. Governments and defense industries are generally observing the embargo, but there is a global glut of cheap weapons. Many get through to the former country. One expert said arms come from the former Soviet bloc, South Africa, France, Singapore, and Chile. But the publisher of Jane's Defense Weekly says just because the weapons come from those countries, this doesn't mean those countries' governments are selling them. The experts say black marketeers and unidentified third-party entrepreneurs are getting the weapons through. Attorney General William Barr today rejected a House Judiciary Committee request for the appointment of an independent counsel to investigate allegations of possible criminal conduct in the handling of U.S. pre-war Iraq policy. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
In a 14-page letter, Attorney General Barr said there is no basis for a probe. He said the Judiciary Committee's request for an investigation contains vague and general allegations and lists a number of statutes that may have been violated. Specific charges against named individuals are required for the appointment of an independent counsel, said Barr. The committee is looking into a number of allegations: that the Bush administration knew that Iraq used pre-war U.S. food assistance to buy weapons, that the administration interfered in a federal investigation of a bank that handled the food loans to Iraq, and that the administration falsified documents given to congressional committees. Democrats on the Judiciary Committee accused Barr of a politically motivated cover-up. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
Stock prices closed mixed on Wall Street today. The Dow gained about 5 points to end at 3337.58. Declines led advances in moderate trading. This is NPR. Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin is meeting with President Bush in Kennebunkport, Maine. The two leaders are holding 2 days of meetings on a variety of topics. President Bush announced today that all parties in the Mideast peace talks will resume negotiating on August 24th. Also central to the leaders' discussion is strengthening relations between the two countries. U.S. officials say they expect President Bush to endorse all or part of a plan for loan guarantees to Israel to help provide housing and job training for Soviet emigres. In Los Angeles, four police officers accused of beating Rodney King pleaded not guilty to federal civil rights charges today. NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports.
One at a time, officers Lawrence Powell, Timothy Wind, and Theodore Brasino stepped to the lectern and pleaded innocent to charges they had violated King's Fourth Amendment rights, which protect against unreasonable arrest. The fourth defendant, Sergeant Stacy Kuhn, pleaded innocent to charges that he violated King's 14th Amendment rights, requiring due process, when he failed to stop his officers from beating Rodney King. After the pleas were entered, a judge, John Davies, was selected at random to hear the case. But Davies is already assigned to hear King's multi-million-dollar civil suit against the city of Los Angeles and the police department. Davies could excuse himself from the civil rights case on grounds of possible conflict of interest. The judge is on vacation and could not be reached for comment. A tentative trial date was set for September 29th, but that date may well be postponed. In Los Angeles, this is Wendy Kaufman reporting.
California officials say one stubborn 900-acre blaze in Big Sur is the only major forest fire still not contained in the West. But fire watchers are preparing for a new round of blazes now that weather forecasters are predicting a heat wave throughout this week. Thousands of firefighters tamed 16 major fires and dozens of smaller ones in six states since the beginning of this month. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. It's difficult to document a culture that is forced to remain hidden. Until the gay liberation movement, there was very little in the way of gay and lesbian history. Lillian Faderman is one of the writers who's been telling the story of this formerly invisible subculture. Faderman is a professor at California State University in Fresno and has written extensively about lesbian literature and history. She's the author of Odd Girls and Twilight Lovers, a study of lesbian subcultures through the 20th century. Terry talked to Faderman when the book first came out. It's now available in paperback. Faderman found that lesbian subcultures had a lot to tell us about changing views of class, morality, and gender in America. In the 1950s, for instance, Faderman says the lesbian subculture was defined by class.
For example, middle-class women didn't dare generally to frequent the gay bars. Lesbian bars in those days were called gay girls' bars. They didn't dare participate in that visible aspect of the subculture. And so their subculture was often made up of private parties and dinner parties and things that were much less visible than what working-class lesbians and young lesbians did. Young lesbians often went to gay girls' bars. Those bars frequently encourage the establishment of butch and femme roles and role-playing and relationships, such as tended not to exist in such an obvious way among middle-class women.
Why do you think that in the 1950s there was so much emphasis on butch and femme roles within
the working
relationships
class
between women
and
the
young community? I want to emphasize not so much among middle class women, but I think it was partly because roles in the parent society were just so pronounced, mm-hmm. so insistent. That is, men had to be manly men and women had to be very feminine women, and I think that young lesbians and working class lesbians were very influenced by the parent society. It's not true, I'm sure, for all women who found themselves in butch and femme relationships. I'm sure some of those women felt that it simply came natural to them. They were doing what was right for them. But within the bar scene, women who didn't feel particularly masculine or particularly feminine were frequently encouraged to choose one role or another and play that role within the relationship.
Well, you interviewed lots of women for your new book. Did you find that a lot of women did feel that they didn't fit in either butch or femme and had to choose one and felt uncomfortable after they did?
Yeah, I talk about some interesting stories that I was told in the course of these interviews. One woman, for example, told me that one night she was going to a bar to meet another woman who identified as a butch, and so she dressed in a very feminine way to be a counterpart to this other woman. The other woman didn't show up, and so the woman I interviewed decided that she would go to another bar, and in the car she changed clothes. She changed from her feminine clothes to her butch clothes because she said she just wanted to meet another woman, and butches had more opportunity to be aggressive, to introduce themselves, to take the dominant position in a relationship that they would start in a bar. And so for her, it was extremely flexible.
Well, in talking about lesbian subcultures, there's a really interesting and dramatic change that takes place in the latter part of the 1960s, both because of the counterculture and its attitudes towards love, and also because of the feminist movement. Let's start with the counterculture and what was sometimes called free love. Did that put same-sex love into a different context?
Yes, I think it did, particularly coming out of phenomena such as the hippie movement, the New Left, the general tenor of the times in which experimentation was encouraged, the growth of the second wave of the feminist movement, and then, of course, at the end of the 1960s, the Stonewall Rebellion, the beginning of the gay liberation movement. I think that the 60s gave birth to a whole different kind of lesbian from the women that I first knew when I came out as a lesbian in the lesbian bars of the mid-1950s.
What are some of those differences?
Well, I want to distinguish, first of all, between two sets of lesbians. Some lesbians who worked within the gay liberation movement, who felt that where they hurt most was as homosexuals, and it was really to their benefit to bring about reforms to get rid of discrimination against homosexuals. There were other lesbians, however, who came out through feminism or who identified mostly as feminists, and they felt where they hurt most was not necessarily as homosexuals, but as women. That is, even if homosexuals had all sorts of freedoms, they would be discriminated against as women. And those women very often became feminists first and then radical feminists and then saw lesbianism as the only logical conclusion to feminism. And they became political lesbians first. That is, their attitude was any woman could choose to be a lesbian.
But don't you think it's interesting that in the late 1960s, perhaps for the first time in history, you have sexuality becoming, in part, a political and cultural decision?
Yes. Yes, I think that's true. And again, I think it comes out of the wonderful ferment and upheaval of the 1960s, where we felt that anything was possible, that one could choose to live a lesbian lifestyle, and that it was a viable political and cultural choice.
We're listening to an interview that Terry did with historian Lillian Faderman. She's the author of the book Odd Girls and Twilight Lovers. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening to an interview that Terry did with historian Lillian Faderman.
You say in your book that since so many women decided to become lesbian to get away from sexist political or emotional relationships, that lesbianism became seen by some women as a cure-all for all the ills of sexism. And I wonder what kind of impossible expectations you think that put on certain lesbian relationships.
Yeah, I think that's a good question. It seems to me that many women who became lesbians during the 1970s expected those relationships to be utopian, to be perfect in every way. And of course, lesbian relationships are human relationships, and there's no way that human relationships can be simply perfect forever. And I think a number of those women were disappointed. Many of them then developed more realistic expectations and have remained lesbians. Others felt that since it was hard to live as a lesbian in a culture that was primarily heterosexual and relationships weren't perfect, they may as well go back to heterosexuality again. There's a term for those women, incidentally. They're called has-beens.
You say something in the book that I think is very funny. I'm not sure if you meant it to be funny or not. But you say in the 1950s, there was a lot of role-playing between butch and femme. In the 1970s, so many lesbian feminists just saw themselves as butch, just dressed butch.
Right. I don't think they would have identified themselves specifically as butch if they were asked seriously, are you butch or femme? But I think the style was androgynous. I think that many radical feminists, and certainly lesbian feminists as part of the radical feminist movement, felt that it was playing into patriarchy to wear high heels and dresses and makeup and all of those artifacts of heterosexuality. Women did it simply to please men, and as lesbian feminists, of course, they would have nothing of it.
What kind of splits do you think there were in the 1970s between lesbians who came out primarily for political reasons, to get away from sexism, and lesbians for whom it was really more of a basic sexual orientation?
Yeah, there was some conflict during the 1970s on the basis of those different ways to come at lesbianism. I think that many women who had been lesbians long before the 1970s, old gays as they were called for a while, really felt that young lesbian feminists just didn't know what it was all about, that they came into lesbianism in an era of relative freedom, really vast freedom from the perspective of women who came out in the 1950s, and they took for granted all of these privileges. They had no way of identifying with the struggles of older lesbians. And so there was a lot of resentment on the one hand. But on the other hand, I interviewed a number of women who had come out in the 1950s and became lesbian feminists in the 70s. And they thought that they had died and gone to heaven, that suddenly the whole world was open to them, that there were all of these wonderful cultural representations, such as women's music and women's novels. And what I mean by women is lesbian. The term was generally used synonymously at the height of lesbian feminism. Women's publishing houses, women's coffee houses, all sorts of cultural places to go and to be a lesbian.
What is happening today with younger lesbians who are, you know, coming of age now, who are in their late teens or in their early 20s, their late 20s? Do you see a different kind of subculture emerging?
Yeah, I really envy younger lesbians, and I'm very happy for them because I think there's much more choice now. One can be a lesbian feminist, as women were in the 1970s. One can be involved in a butch and femme relationship, as women, working class and young lesbians were in the 1950s. One could be a lipstick lesbian, which is a term that was current for a while in the late 1980s. And
what's this? Yeah.
A lipstick lesbian dresses in high heels and skirts and makeup and still calls herself a lesbian, doesn't think there's any kind of uniform, as she would put it, that she has to don. There isn't any sort of appearance that she has to plug into. She can just do it her own way.
You write in the book that you believe that lesbians aren't necessarily born different. In other words, that it really might be a choice that you make as opposed to just something inherent in your makeup.
Right. I really think that the Kinsey scale established by Alfred Kinsey in the early 1950s is very telling about human sexuality. Kinsey created a scale from 0 to 6. 0 meant a person who was totally heterosexual. 6 meant a person who was totally homosexual. And what he discovered is that there were very few zeros and very few sixes. People who identified as heterosexual tended to be 1 or 2 on the Kinsey scale. That is, they had some homosexual experience. People who identified as homosexual tended to be 4 or 5 on the Kinsey scale. They had some heterosexual experience. What that indicates is that people are really diverse within their own lives sexually, and at any given time, a person can be heterosexual primarily or homosexual primarily. I think that's very good evidence of the fact that one isn't simply born heterosexual or born homosexual.
And you don't think there should be pressure on people to worry about consistency in their choices?
No, not at all, no. I think it's wonderful if people could feel open about who they are and open to express themselves according to whatever else is happening in their lives at a particular time.
You came out in the 1950s. Did you fit into any of the subcultures that you described earlier?
Well, I experienced various subcultures. I first was brought by a gay boy, as we called gay men in those days, to a gay girls' bar that was a working class bar where butches and femmes were in very different kinds of roles, really made distinctions between them. About a year later, I was taken by another friend to not a gay girl's bar, but a gay woman's cocktail lounge. It was one of the few middle-class lesbian bars in Los Angeles, the city in which I lived at that time. And there, the women didn't fit into butch and femme roles, at least not in any visible kind of way. The women generally wore tailored suits and high heels and makeup and were fairly uniformly feminine, at least in their visible appearance, although what they did in private might have been very different from their visible appearance. And so I sort of lived in both cultures for a period of time.
When did the gay liberation movement start to directly affect your life?
I think it did as soon as I read about the Stonewall Rebellion in 1969. That was so incredible that finally here were some homosexuals that would not simply stand for being taken off in a paddy wagon and booked and held overnight in jail and demeaned. At the same time, or immediately after that, there was the establishment of the lesbian feminist movement when suddenly thousands and thousands of women were saying what I had felt my whole life, that is, they were taking a feminist approach to politics, analyzing the world in feminist terms, and that, too, was extremely liberating for me.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. I enjoyed it.
Lillian Faderman is the author of the book Odd Girls and Twilight Lovers. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel has joined us to tell us about All Things Considered today. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Marty. How are you? Today in the program, we'll be hearing news that the U.S. Attorney General has decided not to create a special prosecutor to investigate the case they call Iraqgate. I will also be hearing about a call from conservative Republicans to President Bush to propose a tax cut in the GOP platform. Mara Liasson on the campaign trail with Vice President Dan Quayle. Also, Daniel Zwerdling reporting on the enormous differences between housing for whites and blacks in South Africa. And we'll be hearing about moves at the United Nations and at NATO to prepare for possible new steps in Bosnia.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Some people have a funny way of popping in and out of our lives. Rock historian Ed Ward says he's got an old acquaintance like that, one he'd lost track of until just a few days ago.
I picked up the paper the other day and read that my former neighbor Arthur has a new job, one that allows him to use some of his talent, more anyway than his house painting gig did. I haven't been in such close touch with Arthur since he moved from the small house a block or so from mine that I used to pass each evening as I walked my dog. That was about 10 years ago, shortly after Arthur and his family had moved to Austin. Because I was the music columnist at the Daily Paper, and he was trying to make a comeback, he made sure I knew who he was, and from time to time he'd call me at the paper to slip me a tidbit. According to the story that ran last week, Arthur's gone into business with a psychotherapist named Jim Maxwell in a business called Healing Songs. The way the thing works is that you go and talk to Maxwell for 45 minutes about a single issue that's bothering you, and then Arthur picks up his guitar and makes up a song that will enable you to take the insight you've gained from the session home with you to play when you need to gain access to it again. All of which is, like Arthur, a bit dotty and a bit new agey. But I wonder how many clients of healing songs remember Arthur from the old days, and how much healing they'd get if they plugged in their counseling session cassette and heard him announce,
"I am the god of hellfire, and I bring you fire.
Yes, folks, Arthur Brown of the Crazy World of Arthur Brown, whose one and only hit record, Fire, rose to number 2 on the pop charts and sold over 1 million copies in 1968, is now doing psychotherapy in Central Texas. Still, I wouldn't fear for anyone's psyche in this affair. Arthur's a lovable British eccentric in the classic tradition. Just because 24 years ago he used to paint his face and leap around singing in a helmet that was spewing flames doesn't mean he hasn't changed his ways. In fact, shortly after The Who's Pete Townsend saw Arthur's act, signed his band, and watched them hit the top, the Crazy World's drummer, Carl Palmer, quit to join one of the worst bands in British history, Emerson, Lake & Palmer. Arthur's next band, Kingdom Come, was real theatrical and made concept albums in the early 70s, but never really got anywhere, and Arthur disappeared for a while, touring the Middle East and getting interested in the guru Gurdjieff. When he got back to London, one old friend remembered him. Pete Townsend gave him the role of the priest in the movie version of Tommy. According to my reference books, Arthur kept grinding out albums through the end of the 70s, at which point his fellow Gurdjieffian, Peter Fripp, encouraged him to move to Austin. He made a couple more albums, but spent most of his time painting houses and playing in a blues band with Jimmy Carl Black, the Indian of the group, from the Mothers of Invention. The band was called, of course, Black, Brown, and Blues. And Austin needed another blues band, like the proverbial hole in the head. Actually, I've bumped into Arthur a lot recently, and I've never seen him happier. I wouldn't hazard a guess as to the efficacy of his therapy, but it seems to be doing him good. Anyway, that other stuff could wear a guy out.
Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle and is currently working on a book about Chess Records. Today's Fresh Air was produced by Deborah Beagle, Danny Miller, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, and Joan Tuohy. Our engineers this week are Audrey Vablitis, Thad Kirk, and Ron Barron. Seuss Bolin directed the show. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, an interview with filmmaker Errol Morris. The director of The Thin Blue Line has just completed a documentary on the esteemed physicist Stephen Hawking. Hawking has a degenerative disease that has all but immobilized his body while leaving his brilliant mind unharmed. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.